This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown. I'm Eric Tome. I'm going to be here till 2 p.m. with two very different interviews to two authors, one of whom is going to be appearing in San Francisco, the end of the week with a fascinating new book, and the other, a relative of mine who has a book in the works that will probably come out in about a year and a half. And unless you're too worried about nepotism, it's a very good book and a very good writer, as I think you'll find out in the second half of the program. Nina Jablonski is the new head of the Department of Anthropology at Penn State University. She's only took over her duties there about a month ago. Before that, she'd worked at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco, and it was while she was there that she did her research on human skin and its many aspects, from how it works as a membrane to the different kinds of skins that are required in different climates, how color changes, how texture changes, what your fingerprints are good for, and hundreds of fascinating small topics in a short but very informative book. She's going to be appearing this Friday. She'll be back in an event sponsored by the California Academy of Sciences. It's going to be at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, their Canbar Theater at 3200 California Street in San Francisco. If you're interested in attending the event, you can get ticket information at 415-321-8000. I talked to her about a week ago, and we're going to spend the first part of the program listening to what she had to say. What is skin, and why is it so important?
Skin is probably one of the most remarkable organs in the human body, certainly the largest. It's incredibly important to humans because it forms the protective surface of our body. It protects us from a variety of environmental elements, some of them very obvious to us, some of them not very obvious, but very dangerous, things like dangerous chemicals and bacteria and the like. And so it's a protective cladding. But in addition to that, it serves as a factory because it produces certain substances that are essential for our normal life, vitamin D being one of them, that it produces in response to contact with the sun. And the third thing that is incredibly important is that humans do a lot with their skin because it's on the outside of our bodies and it's functionally naked. And because humans are extremely clever kinds of animals, we affix all sorts of things to it. Sometimes temporarily we smear our bodies with paint of various kinds. Other times we do permanent changes to its appearance. By way of making permanent statements of our identity or advertising something about us. And so it serves an important set of biological functions, but an equally important set of cultural functions. And there's probably no part of the body like that.
So it's not just like the wall of a cell.
No, it's not just like the wall of a cell, or it's not like an organ like the pancreas or the liver or something, which, you know, is very much on the inside and it does incredibly important jobs, but we don't really do anything with those organs. It's not part of our external interface with the world. And so the skin occupies a unique position in that it's so large, it's so important as biological protection and a biological factory, but it also serves this welter of cultural functions which are unique to humans.
Although you do point out that there have been various different kinds of skins once you get beyond one-celled animals. Fish have one kind of skin, reptiles have another, mammals have another.
Yes. Yes, very much. And skin has evolved in fascinating and complex ways as vertebrate creatures have evolved over the last hundreds of millions of years. And especially as animals have had to adapt through time to various conditions on dry land. So amphibians and subsequently the earliest reptiles and then birds and mammals, we find a whole host of adaptations occurring in the skin to make it possible for animals to live outside of an aquatic environment. And so one of the most important functions for all of these creatures is for the skin to basically serve as a water barrier, help to preserve fluids within the body, and keep unwanted fluids outside of the body from getting in.
You write quite lyrically about the scaly skin of reptiles, but then point out that it was inadequate when animals evolved a little farther.
That's right. You know, we see some skins adapted extremely well, you know, to their particular functions. But reptilian skin is not necessarily good for a bird or a mammal. And so we've seen, you know, in the evolution of those lineages of animals, we've seen new innovations, and especially the evolution of feathers in birds and hair in mammals has enhanced the specific kind of protection that they need, some of the most important being insulation in order to keep their body heat inside their bodies.
This happened when birds and mammals became warm-blooded.
That's right. And what's fascinating is that these were independent events. We had the evolution of feathers from a reptilian ancestral form, and then we have the evolution of the earliest hairs from slightly different reptilian precursors. So reptile skin was very good in serving reptiles, but it absolutely had to be modified in these warm-blooded lineages of other vertebrates, specifically birds and mammals.
Because reptiles had to be in a warm place if they wanted to be warm.
That's right.
Or had to hibernate.
Right. And reptiles are very good in regulating their temperature through the range of activities that they undertake. So reptiles, as we all know from observing lizards and so forth, is that they will go out during the course of the day to warm up so that they can then be active. They don't have endogenous or internal heat that allows them to keep going as birds and mammals do.
So as birds and mammals evolved, they developed these elaborate feathers and fur, and then as humans evolved, we dumped them.
That's right. I mean, it's an amazing story because in the history of mammals, and if we look at the human lineage through the great expanse of time, we go from vertebrates that had scales to vertebrates that had hairs, our mammalian ancestors, our primate ancestors that had lots of hair, and then humans losing their hair for very, very good biological reasons, specifically that it's wonderful to have hair when you need to keep warm and you need to keep a lot of body heat around your body. But if you need to get rid of a lot of body heat, hair can be a positive impediment. And it turns out that humans are from a primate lineage where sweating is the way to keep cool. And if you have a lot of hair and you're trying to keep cool by sweating, it just doesn't work. Because once your hair gets really wet, you no longer can keep as cool, and your body sort of, in a sense, boils over. It doesn't, the physiological process of cooling doesn't work efficiently. And so in the course of human evolution, we guess this happened probably around 2 million years ago, humans have actually lost most of their body hair in order to facilitate cooling using sweating. So we're an extremely sweaty, naked type of mammal.
And as we got more naked, our skin started turning different colors.
Yes.
I think it's interesting.
And this was probably one of the most important aspects of the evolution of our own genus, the genus Homo. When we see the earliest members of this group emerging, they are really much different in their overall body size and reconstructed activity levels than previous more ape-like members of the human lineage. These earliest members of the genus Homo were tall, strapping, highly active, bipedal creatures. These people were moving around in the open savanna under very hot conditions, and they were being active. They were foraging, scavenging over long distances, activities that required them to be able to keep cool. Now, it's great, okay, you lose your hair and you start evolving increased numbers of sweat glands, but if your skin is vulnerable to damage from the sun as a result of having no hair on it, how are you going to manage? Because the sun, especially the ultraviolet rays in the sun, are potentially incredibly damaging to the human body.
You do point out that most mammals, their default skin color, we don't notice it, is a sort of pink.
That's right.
And it's only when it's exposed to the sun, like the noses of dogs or the muzzles of monkeys, that they get darker.
That's right. Because, you know, if you dig underneath your dog or your cat's fur, in most cases what you find is actually very light-colored skin covered by dark hair. And this is certainly the case in most of our primate relatives. And so when we initially lost our hair or started the process of losing our hair, we were dealing with essentially a pink skin, extremely vulnerable to damage from the sun. And that's why, as we think about this process of the evolution of human skin color, as we lost our hair, we must have increased the amount of pigmentation in the skin. It couldn't have been otherwise, because the skin, naked and pink, would have been extremely vulnerable to the damaging ultraviolet rays of tropical sunlight. And so we reconstruct that the earliest members of our genus, the genus Homo, were darkly pigmented people, and that through time, people living near the equator have remained darkly pigmented and elaborated that so as to maximize the protection, the natural protection in their skin. The pigment that makes skin dark, melanin, is an amazing natural sunscreen that absorbs ultraviolet radiation and basically takes a lot of the damaging energy out of ultraviolet radiation. And it also is a sort of a chemical sponge that helps to sop up damaged molecules that are caused by ultraviolet radiation. So it's quite a remarkable kind of molecule. It's found all throughout the natural world. But we use it in humans to great advantage to color our skin. And so we, as in our own lineage, the earliest members of our lineage, the genus Homo, were darkly pigmented. And then as we started fanning out throughout the world outside of the tropics for the first time, then we began to lose this coloration again. And so this is one of the interesting reversals. Again, we lost, we gained hair in our mammalian history, then we lost it. We didn't have pigment in our skin, and then we gained it when we were in our hairless equatorial living phase. And then when humans started to disperse outside of the tropics, they had to lose the pigment in their skin to greater or lesser extents, depending on what sun regime they moved to.
So they got lighter skin, they also had to get more skin, because I guess when you're in a warmer area, it's good to have less surface area to be tall and thin, and when you're in a cooler area, it's better to have be a little shorter and rounder.
Yes, and actually what's interesting when you look at peoples who live in the tropics and whose ancestors have lived in the tropics for tens of thousands of years, you actually see people with a very large surface area. They're tall and thin, and when you actually measure the total surface area of their skin, it's significantly larger than the surface area of people living in far northern latitudes, because you want to decrease the total surface area under those conditions. Basically, under hot conditions, you want the maximum sweating area so that you can lose heat through the maximum surface area. In cold conditions, you want to reduce that area that is likely to lose body heat.
But losing the melanin also, or reducing the amount, has some not-so-good consequences as well.
That's right. I mean, losing melanin does render us more susceptible to damage from ultraviolet radiation. And anyone who has relatively light skin knows that when they go out in the sun for too long a period of time without appropriate clothing or without chemical sunscreen, they know that they can get a very uncomfortable and, what they may not know, is a dangerous sunburn as a result of a lack of melanin in their skin. But in the history of humans, those of us whose ancestors evolved in high latitudes really needed to have relatively little pigment in our skin, because the amount of ultraviolet radiation that would impact on the skin during the whole year would be relatively low and would not generally cause serious life-threatening damage. So we might get the occasional sunburn, but there would not be any serious damage that would threaten our survival or our reproductive success. And that was the real key, that yes, we lost pigment and that we were susceptible to some sun damage, but that basically the loss of pigment helped us to live successfully and reproduce successfully under conditions of low ultraviolet radiation.
But these additions and subtractions of pigment have happened in different places among different populations, and they don't really have anything to do with what we would call race.
That's right. And this is one of the most fascinating and important aspects of our research, and actually it draws upon the research of many other people. We hypothesized, just on the basis of what we knew of human history, that this must have been the case, that light skin, for instance, must have evolved more than once independently in human history. And similarly, the dark skin would have evolved more than once in human history as humans re-entered tropical areas from non-tropical regions. But what has been fascinating in the last few years, as the Human Genome Project has gained more ground and more information has come to light, is that we can now see that independent genetic mutations for light skin, for instance, in humans, have occurred in modern human history. And so the ancestors of people living in Eastern Asia who are white, quite lightly pigmented, and the ancestors of people living in Western Europe who are also quite lightly pigmented, in fact, underwent loss of pigmentation independently. There wasn't a common depigmented ancestor, most likely. There was a common dark ancestor that underwent independent genetic changes to have a lightly pigmented skin.
And this is in historical time?
That's right. Well, it's, you know, for an anthropologist, this is historical time. This is the last 100,000 years or so, or the last 50,000 years. Most people wouldn't consider this just yesterday, but for anthropologists, this is during the history of our own species, Homo sapiens. And this has tremendous implications for how we think about the evolution of skin color and race, because we need to think about skin color being one of these aspects of human appearance that is so important to our survival that it has to have changed quite regularly in response to changes in human positions on the globe, where human populations find themselves. And so we end up looking at the human, at the array of human populations today, many lightly pigmented, many darkly pigmented. If these lightly pigmented and darkly pigmented peoples have evolved separately at separate times, what is a white race? What is a black race? It's a total nonsense. It doesn't make any sense. We have examples of black or nearly black skin evolving more than once in human history. We have examples of white or nearly white skin evolving more than once. And so what do we call these people? I mean, it just doesn't make sense to label them according to skin color, because similar skin colors have evolved more than once, in fact, probably repeatedly in human history.
You write about skin as an organ of touch and an organ of emotional sensitivity. Is there a difference among different groups in the world, either because of pigmentation or because of the climate they live in the way they're, the sensitivity of their skin?
There doesn't seem to be any difference between peoples in their sensitivity based on their pigmentation or where they live, but there do seem to be differences between people that are cultivated as a result of the cultures in which they're brought up. So it doesn't matter what color you are or where you live, but if you're brought up in a culture in which touch is something that is welcomed and that is used to reinforce social bonds, then you'll be much more touch-oriented and touch-sensitive than a person who grows up in a culture where touching is not so welcomed or condoned, in a sort of a touch-averse society, as it were. Humans have a tremendous ability to gain information through the sense of touch, but some cultures clearly take much more advantage of it than others. In American culture, for instance, through the last 100 years or so, we've become generally much more touch-averse, at least in public situations, largely from the point of view of legal defensibility. If you're in the workplace, you have to be able to have a very professional setting where people are not potentially maliciously molesting or touching one another. And so we've come to have a lot of sanctions about touch in the workplace, and some of these even spill over into private lives, where people become quite touch-averse even in their private lives. And so these things vary more according to culture than by any other parameter.
Although there's one of the cliches is that tropical people are more passionate and more likely to touch one another, and people close to the poles are cooler and more reserved and more remote.
I think,
is that true?
Part of that may simply be that people near the tropics or in the tropics have much more skin exposed at any one particular time. It's much more satisfying to touch skin or to have your skin touched rather than touching the edge of a garment, you know, a hem, a sleeve, or something like this. And so people living closer to the equator generally wear fewer clothes and make themselves sort of more available for touch whereas people living in colder climes just have much less skin exposed for that purpose.
You've talked about the way that, say, pigmentation has evolved. Right now, people are no longer restricted in where they live. So what is going to happen? Are we all going to interbreed and just come out of a sort of light chocolate color, or there be some sort of evolution, a new kind of skin color that'll be adaptable to being in the Arctic 1 week and the equator the next week?
Well, there are a few things that one can say in connection with this. The first is that in many parts of the world, as people share more and more cultural matters, there is more and more mingling and more interaction and more marriages and breeding opportunities between people from distant whose ancestors hail from distant parts of the world. So, for instance, in many urban centers around the world, you see people of all hues of the sepia rainbow, you know, from the palest to the darkest, with every combination in between, and people of remarkable, combinations of colors. And so these will continue to be, I think, culturally on the increase as more and more people share cultures, especially in urban settings. So we will see a sort of an increasing tawniness of generalization of human skin color. But the other thing is that as humans of whatever color go from one place to another, they bring with them in modern culture a whole bunch of stuff that allows them to adapt to wherever they're living. Lightly pigmented peoples, when they go for vacations in the tropics or on the equator, bring with them not very many clothes, but the abilities to seek shelter and to protect themselves against the sun using special clothing or chemical sunscreens. So we have a lot of culture that protects us against the sun when we move into very sunny areas. Similarly, when darkly pigmented people move to areas of low sun, they have their own cultural ways of dealing with a reduced sun load. And for many of these people now, taking vitamin D supplements to top up their natural production of vitamin D in their skin is one of the most important cultural adaptations that they make. So my point is, people aren't going to be evolving, their skin isn't going to be evolving as they move from one generation to another in modern times. Rather, we're going to be making cultural accommodations primarily to the rapidity of our movement.
That was Nina Jablonski, the professor and head of the Department of Anthropology at Penn State University. She was, until this summer, a staff member at the California Academy of Sciences, where she prepared the many studies of human skin she's done over the last 15 years, but in particular, this book that's just come out from the University of California Press, Skin, A Natural History. She'll be appearing at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco this Friday at 8 p.m. That's at 3200 California Street in San Francisco. It's sponsored by the California Academy of Sciences, and if you want ticket information, you can go to 415-321-8000. This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm going to be with you till 2 p.m. I'm about to try something I've never quite done before, and fortunately, I have a friendly subject to try this out on. The person we're going to talk to next, for the next half of the program, is, I guess you'd call, my cousin-in-law, Alex Beam. Are you there, Alex?
In fact, I am here.
Okay, and in fact, I guess, in any case, Alex is married to my cousin, Kirsten, and we've known each other for many years. I've read his books, but in addition to being a family member, he's also a columnist for the Boston Globe, has written two novels about his life in Russia, where he and his wife met, fellow travelers and the Americans are coming. And an earlier nonfiction book, which we discussed a couple of years ago, called Gracefully Insane, The Rise and Fall of America's Premier Mental Hospital, about McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts, a Harvard-run institution that has housed some of the most influential and richest crazy people in America over the last century or so. He's got a new project now, which interests me very much, partly because of where I grew up and how I grew up, and it's about the great books. So what are the great books, Alex, and what are you planning to do in the next year and a half?
Well, I have a contract to write a sort of critical, possibly even a sort of wry, W-R-Y, history of what I'm calling the great books movement in America, which in fact, for the purposes of our discussion, is really a Chicago story, as you know, because you and I have chatted about this briefly. It comes from somewhere else, and it sort of ends up somewhere else. But the kind of lovely, red hot, throbbing center of what I'm writing about, it takes place at the University of Chicago, starting almost immediately after this incredible 29-year-old Yale Law School professor named Robert Hutchins is appointed president of the University of Chicago, which was certainly one of America's largest, at the time, newest and most ambitious universities. And he immediately brings in this man who becomes a kind of towering cultural icon of the middle of the 20th century, this guy Mortimer Adler, whom he had worked with on a very abstruse project, writing a textbook on evidence for the Yale Law School. And Adler had basically been tossed out of Columbia for all the usual sins. I mean, he would later be tossed out of Chicago, and now that he's no longer with us, Adler's a difficult person to judge. He rubs everyone the wrong way, but possibly for the right reasons. But in any case, Hutchins and Adler, starting in the early 30s at Chicago, they want to make a mark. They're both sort of men who like to be the center of attention, and they want to put Chicago on the map very, very aggressively. And they sort of tear up the playbook, which is meaningful in many different ways. And they say, you know, these kids don't know anything. These kids are being taught a ridiculous kind of mishmash of engineering, the fairy queen, you know, and Russian language. So we're going to basically, we're going to enforce what they called the general honors curriculum and what later became known as the core curriculum. We're going to basically tell these kids what they have to study for 2 years. And astonishingly, if we think about today's young men and women in college courses, Hutchins and Adler decided to teach what was called freshman honors when it was first introduced, because it was for freshmen. They taught the course themselves, and they sat down with 20 boys and girls from the University of Chicago, and they adopted this great books format, which they had stolen from Columbia, where a very well-regarded professor named John Erskine had done exactly the same thing. Erskine's modus operandi, which lives on to this day, and we can talk about that later, was to get kids around a table, assign one book a week, and my own knowledge of great books isn't so great, but I don't know, let's say instead of one book, four Aeschylus plays. And there would be no talk, no lecture by the teachers. There would always be two teachers per class, but they would be known as tutors. And they would guide the discussion, but never sort of tell the class who Aeschylus was, when he lived. That was sort of not considered relevant. What was considered relevant was to experience, say, the greatness of Aeschylus for 2 hours in class with a guided discussion. At Columbia, some of the most famous names of the intellectual establishment of the time, Clifton Fadiman, Mark Van Doren, and a couple of others whose names are escaping me, led the seminars with this guy John Erskine. So that was the idea, it was a devilishly simple idea, and the ideology behind it was that Socrates, Aeschylus, Gibbon, virtually, you know, Anna Karenina, virtually any great book could speak to the public, and that you didn't need a man or woman with a PhD to kind of tell you, you know, where Aeschylus got some of his diction or his metric style. Their point of departure was the truly great books were always sort of for the people. They may have been written by geniuses, but the target audience was always the person in the street.
Although what's so fascinating about the great books, I'm not sure and if this is how they started out, but when they finally came up with the 54 volumes, they'd included classic works of mathematics from Euclid and Ptolemy through Galileo and so on, and Newton, which would be very difficult for most people just to pick up.
Yes, that's exactly right.
But this may be getting away from what you want to talk about right now.
No, I don't mind your pointing that out. I mean, that's when, in a sense, they, you know, that at Chicago, they developed this conceit that you could learn everything from the ancients. And so obviously the professors of science and mathematics said, well, wait a minute. And then really quite ignorantly, Adler, Hutchins, and their gang, as you point, they threw in, like I have the names here, they threw in, say, you know, Faraday, Newton, Fourier, Lavoisier. In other words, the great sort of science, Galileo, Harvey, Humphrey Gilbert. You know, these are the great names of the Enlightenment, basically, 18th century scientific writers, Kepler, Copernicus, and even Ptolemy, whom I think you mentioned, which I think has been quite fairly held out to be ridiculous. I mean, it had college students, you know, trying to master the Ptolemaic universe. It's hard to make a case for, although, I mean, I believe that Ptolemy is still taught at the St. John's Colleges. I mean, I don't know, and I'm looking forward to finding out.
Yeah, that's something I was going to bring up, and I'm not sure either, although I do have a nephew who was a student at St. John's, and I think they still do teach all the ancient mathematicians.
Yeah, I'm certain they teach some of them. And, you know, if we continue talking, that's something we'll talk about in the future, because I'm about to go, you know, to this conference next week and try and approach, I guess maybe the head of St. John's is going to be there, and I'd like to spend a few days down there and see how they structure, you know, just to anticipate, they structure a whole four-year curriculum purely out of the great books.
Now, we could spend the next 15 minutes going through the history, and I think we will in the next couple of times we talk. The idea is that I'll call Alex maybe every 4 to 6 months over the next year and a half and see how the book is progressing, what he's finding out, what his difficulties might be, what his new points of enlightenment might be. But I just want to throw in a bit of personal side from my point of view, which is that I grew up in Chicago in the 1950s, and the air was sort of rife with great books. There were great books, study groups all over. In addition to the big 54 volumes that you could buy, they also had small box sets that might include excerpts from, say, four Greek playwrights or from five political theoreticians. And small groups would be set up all over the place to study these. A lot of it was associated with the University of Chicago. I think all of it that was allowed to use the name was associated with the university, but there were also a lot of people who did it on their own, and it took to somewhat ridiculous lengths. And when we first started talking about this, I realized I have a LP from the Second City, from the first, actually they'd only been going for a year and a half when they put out their first LP in 1961, and the first skit in it is about one of these great books groups. And I know, Alex, you haven't heard this yet, so with your permission, we'll listen to it now, and then maybe we can talk for a minute or two at the end of the program.
Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to hearing it, actually.
Okay, here we go.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, going on with our little music hall show, we present a scene called Great Books. Underneath the arches, I dream of you. Underneath the arches, my dreams are.
Hello there.
Are you a member of this Great Books course?
Yes, I am, but what are you doing here?
Well, Mr. Crenshaw, your regular instructor, is ill, I'm afraid. I'm filling in for him. My name is Throckmorton.
Oh, that's too bad. How do you do?
How do you do?
My name is Stratford, Belden Stratford.
Oh, yeah. Won't you have a seat, Miss Stratford?
Yes, I think these chairs are arranged strangely.
Yes, well, so are we all.
Hi, Great Books. Great Scott. Hi, Belden. Sorry I'm late. I was working down at the agency, and I don't recognize you. You're new, aren't you?
Well, not terribly. I'm 30, but...
Yeah, look it.
Mr. Crenshaw is ill, I'm afraid. I'm filling in for him. My name is Throckmorton.
I'm terribly sorry to hear that. I mean, he's ill, of course, not that you're Throckmorton. My name is Peregrine. Scott Peregrine the Third.
Take three seats.
Touché.
Scott?
Yes, Belden.
I saw you over at Frumpkin's Galleries the other day.
Yes, my wife and I were looking for a primitive. My God, they're sophisticated, you know?
Yes.
Hi!
Hush!
Gosh, where's your dog
team? Thank you.
Hello,
Belden. You look like a million.
Honey, what a cute... You left a price tag on your purse.
Yeah, I think I'm going to return that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the season's over. Anyway, I don't think it's me, huh?
Oh, I think it's you. It's a lovely bag.
Excuse me, ma'am. I hate to be the bearer of bad tidings and all that sort of thing, but Mr. Crenshaw is ill, I'm afraid. I'm filling in for him. My name is Throckmorton. What is yours?
Dallas. Stella F. Dallas.
Stella, sweetie, where did you get that wonderful hat?
We both.
Oh, you like it?
Hi, how are you tonight?
Hi, how are you? Yes, Mommy and I both had the flu.
Oh, that's too bad.
It was rumored that you had mononucleosis.
No one in our family has ever had mononucleosis.
Oh, your mommy's not coming tonight?
No, she's at home tinting her hair blue.
Excuse me, Mr. Peregrine, is this the entire class?
Oh, well, there were a lot more in the class when we started, but War and Peace came along and wiped us out.
Big book.
Indeed, it is a lot.
I'll say, I read every other page.
Well, I trust you've all read every page of tonight's assignment from Mr. Crenshaw, Oedipus Rex by Sophocles.
Boy, I'll say, wow.
Wonderful. Wow. Perhaps we can start things off by deciding for ourselves just what it is about this great book that makes it truly great.
Well, actually, I was wondering about that.
How is that, Mr. Peregrine?
Well, it's interesting, you know.
Oh, yes.
Racy and spicy, and God knows how it gets to the post office, huh? But it's not really a book. It's a play.
Yes, but we've discovered that if you take a play and put it between covers, it becomes a book.
Oh. Oh, no, wait a minute.
Yes, Miss Stratford.
Are you trying to say that anything between covers is a book?
No, no! No,
I'll have to remember that at the agency, Belden. That's marvelous.
Mrs. Dallas, I wonder if you'd perhaps be good enough to get the ball rolling, as it were, by giving us your opinion of this great book?
I'd be delighted. Wonderful. I'd like to say, first of all, I believe it's a great book because it's so old.
Hear, hear.
That it's very difficult to follow, a little sickening here and there. And it has a message.
Ah, yes.
That I miss.
Well, thank you for that much.
Yes.
Miss Stratford, maybe you can add something to what Mrs. Dallas has said.
Well, it certainly will be hard to add to what Mrs. Dallas had to say.
It always is, yes.
Yes, wonderful, Stella, sweetie.
Yes.
Certainly a significant appraisal.
Yes.
Now, could we go on?
Well, I thought it was very pithy.
Pithy, yes.
And highly abstruse.
Indeed.
And everybody, I have my first catharsis.
Oh, congratulations.
Good for you, yes.
It wasn't much. It was a small one, but that's a start.
It certainly is.
Every little thing helps.
Yes, I certainly envy you. I almost had one, but I couldn't quite bring it off somehow. I don't know, I
tried. Not enough pity and fear, Mr. Perry.
That's right, but I agree with Belden. I think it's full of pith.
Yay. Speaking of pity and fear, I wondered if the class knew that the Poetics of Aristotle, the Greek philosopher, you know?
Yes.
was based at least in part on Oedipus Rex. And in the Poetics, Aristotle says that the plot is the soul of a tragedy.
That's wonderful, sir. And of course, you're quite right.
Yes, I know.
I'm very happy. I'm happy that you brought that to the class's attention. I don't believe I got your name when you came in.
Khan. Genghis FX Khan.
You'll find that Khan here, by the way, does a lot of reading on the side.
Oh?
He cheats.
Hold on! Well, now, Mrs. Dallas, you'll find that's allowed. Encouraged.
Yes, but it makes it awfully difficult on the rest of us.
Well, despite the class's hostility, I would like to say that Mummy and I went to Greece last summer, where we visited Mount Kithaeron, where Oedipus was abandoned to the mercy of the elements.
With his ankles pierced, yes.
Yeah, you know, Mummy and I go everywhere together. It's not like we're two individuals. It's always Mummy and Genghis. People always say that.
Well, you and your mother must have gotten a good deal of special significance from this play. If, if we could go on now to a discussion of the motivations in Oedipus. I feel that a fascinating parallel could be drawn between the reactions of the chorus in the play and the public controversy stirred up not too many months ago by Professor Leo F. Koch at the University of Illinois and his views on premarital sexual relations.
Aren't
on the campus.
Straying a little bit from your subject matter, bringing that up in here?
You think just because this is the University of Chicago downtown branch, you can say anything?
After all, you're not our family doctor.
Nor our pastor.
Nor our mother, for that matter.
Don't tell me you agree with this man Koch.
I have no opinion in the matter, one way or another. Yes, Mrs. Dallas.
Mr. Substitute. Are you implying that there's some parallel between Professor Koch and Oedipus?
Well, yes, but only on a moral level.
Oedipus was married.
What moral point are you trying to make this time, dear heart?
I'm not sure I understand her on that.
I'm afraid I get Mrs. Dallas's message. What she is telling us is that there was nothing premarital between Oedipus and his mother.
Oh, wow. That's very good. Good, Stella. I'll buy that. It's a good thing, too. The guy was in enough trouble, don't you think?
Yes. If we could go on now, let's try another tack. What do you think of the universality of this play? I mean, do you feel that it touches upon your lives? Or if not, then how about the lives of someone you know?
Oh, no, that's silly.
I'd like to say I don't think it touches on any one of us here individually,
no.
Genghis, but I'll tell you something. I do know some people quite...
Really?
Well, they're cousins of... I don't know them really too
well.
Oh,
are they Greek?
No. They live on 76 in Jeffrey. You'd be interested in this now.
Miss Stratford, I don't follow you. I don't get your point.
There's this woman that lives with this mere boy.
Oh, that area's gone to the dogs.
Certainly has. I mean, I used to live down at the South Shore Sea
So that was the Second City's take on Great Books in 1961. And Alex is speechless.
Yes, I am. It's a very funny parody of this phenomenon that really, really appears distant from us in time. And that's what sort of the Great Books Foundation did in a way. You know, they were the people that took the Chicago idea and sort of, they claimed at one time to have 50,000 members of Great Books groups, and they were in many major cities in America, et cetera, et cetera. And so those kind of, what Second City is sort of making fun of there are the kind of untutored reactions that you get when you put a purported classic in front of, you know, men and women sort of randomly taken off the street. And I feel my short-term memory must be off, but there were one or two sort of just hilarious lines, obviously about Oedipus and about, you know, is anything between covers a book, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it was sort of the Achilles heel of the enemies of the Great Books movement was that, a lot of silly stuff, I suppose, came out of it. On the other hand, you know, a friend of mine drew my attention to a new memoir of Walker Percy, not by Walker Percy, but, you know, Walker Percy was a member of a Great Books club, actually,
mm-hmm.
Down where he lived.
In Louisiana.
In Louisiana, and Actually, Shelby Foote was a member of the same club.
And Scott, Saul Bellow was one of the research people who helped put together the Syntopicon.
Yes, exactly. I mean, again, we haven't even talked about the Syntopicon, which is in this kind of fascinating category of selling, which really interests me and in a way first sort of got me to this subject, which was that Adler specifically and another guy at Chicago named Benton were really hep on selling the great books. And since it wasn't exactly a blindingly original idea, they did come up with this notion of the Syntopicon, which was supposed to be an index to all the great ideas that had ever been thought or written down. And Bellow was one of the researchers.
And there I'm going to have to cut you off because listening to Second City took up almost 10 minutes of our time. And so we didn't have as much time to talk about this today as I would have liked. But I'll call you again in 4 to 6 months.
That would be fantastic.
And we will just see how the project develops.
Oh, great.
That is your book going to be, what's your book going to be called?
You know, I don't know. It might be called A Great Idea at the Time. And it doesn't have a publication date, and it might be called Tupperware for the Mind.
Something like that. This is Alex Beam, a columnist for the Boston Globe and author of an upcoming book on the great books. We'll be talking to him several times in the next year and a half before it comes out. Thanks a lot, Alex.
Eric, thank you.
And this has been Booktown on KVMR FM Nevada City. Stay tuned for Jimmy Icardi's Rock and Roll Party.